Hey there, folks. Welcome to the edition of Stranger in a Southern Land. I, of course, am your host, Jake Manning. Today on the program, I have Olympic bronze medalist, Reese Hoffa. Reese Hoffa, the world-class shot putter. And actually, shot putting is something I know quite a bit about. I know most people know me as a professional wrestler, maybe a stand-up comedian, hopefully a podcaster since you're listening to this episode. But, shot putting was a hat that I wore before I wore all those hats. I was a Division I scholarship athlete at Western Illinois University where I did the shot put, discus throw, and hammer throw. And actually, my uncle is former world record holder Al Feuerbach. My father was also a decathlete at Western Illinois University as well, and my Uncle Bob was a very well-established collegiate shot putter as well. So the throws of track and field runs through my family. I have a great lineage, and also other members of my family were state qualifiers and state medal winners, and also went on to collegiate careers as well. So it really kind of runs through my family. So it was kind of interesting to sit down with Reese, and I was a little starstruck, I'm not going to lie, because when I first got really deep into track and field, and I get my issue of track and field news every couple weeks, a name that I used to see a lot was Reese Hoffa. And I got to tell you, it's a name that I never thought I'd be sitting down and having a conversation with, especially a wonderful conversation with Reese. Reese, who's getting ready to make his fourth Olympic team. He's getting right now, he's training real hard. And, four Olympic teams, kind of unprecedented, especially in the shot put. I know there's a couple hammer throwers that were able to do the hammer throw a little bit later in life and have long careers. But, shot putting is a very grueling event, far more grueling than what people think, and especially the training for it as far as all the power lifts and stuff like that. But, Reese has got a good team behind him and stuff. Corey was a guy he hooked up with right before he won his bronze medal in 2012. So Reese's got a good team behind him. He also has a fantastic facility in Georgia, the the Hoffa's Throws Academy, that is, based out, I believe, Watkinsville, Georgia, around Athens, Georgia, not far from Georgia University. And Reese has got a fantastic facility. Him and Corey have teamed up, and they're doing wonderful things down there, especially for training and also helping the youth. He's got kids as young as 11 years old learning how to throw the shot, and throw the discus and learning how to throw. And, Reese is doing great and wonderful things. And we sit down and we talk about it. And we talk about the struggles that he went through as well. He went through some tough times trying to claw his way to the top of the shot putting world. And that's where he sits right now. And I'm just very happy to be sitting down with somebody who's a world-class athlete and asking questions like, how did you get here? How did you deal with the adversity? So this is a very good interview for people on all fronts, especially when you're looking for something a little inspirational and knowing how, successful people in their process and how they overcome the challenges that are put forth in front of them. So very happy, very proud to be presenting this conversation to you today. I'm also very happy that this podcast is presented on the Shining Wizards Podcast Network. And of course, it is available at shiningwizardsnetwork.com. It is also available at dsct.tv. That is my producer Don's website. I must thank Don, as always, for all the hard work that he does. He's been here since day one. And also, too, I must thank him because I'm getting this intro to him a little bit late. I'm still a little bit hungover wrestling-wise because of WrestleCon, so Don, I'm very sorry for my tardiness. It's been a very long and very grueling week, but I'm kind of getting through it right now, and I need to get through it because I have some wrestling dates coming up, and I'm going to feed those to you right now. Sunday, April 17th, PWX returns to Charlotte, North Carolina. For more information about that show, make sure you log on to pwxpro.com. And Saturday, April 23rd, Northeast Wrestling is in the Poconos Mountains of Pennsylvania. For more information about that show, just log on to northeastwrestling.com. And Friday, April 29th, Big Time Wrestling. And Saturday, April 30th, Big Time Wrestling also. The 29th will be in Prince George, Virginia. And the 30th will be in Bluefield, West Virginia. For more information about those shows, make sure you log on to btwpro.com. Now, for any changes in those dates or more information about those dates or any upcoming last-minute comedy shows or improv shows that are coming up, the best way to find out about those is by following me on social media, and that is very easy to do. I am very available, and all you have to do is follow me on Twitter, at ManScoutManning and on Instagram at ManScoutManning. If you have a question about the podcast or if you want to become a sponsor of this podcast, all you have to do is just email me at jake@sslshow.com. Or if you're going to book me for an upcoming wrestling event, make sure you email me at manscoutmanning@yahoo.com. Anyways, I've tried to keep this intro very short, very concise, and very direct to the point because I don't want to waste any time because I want to jump headfirst into this conversation with Rhys Hoffa here on Stranger in a Southern Land.
Actually, that's the only way I like to do podcasts.
Have you done a couple before?
Believe it or not, I have attempted to do a podcast on my own.
Oh, you've
but done. I have. I don't have this. This is way more advanced than what I was doing because I don't know what I'm doing pretty much.
Well, I don't either. I just have a good credit limit.
Okay, so the way I did it was. I don't have a camera. I'm just doing it on my iPad. Mm-hmm. And I bought a Yeti microphone.
Yeah.
And it has, you could talk on both sides. So I have some, you have to sit directly across from me and I sit directly in front of you and make sure it's high enough to catch your voice. This is a lot clearer than mine because you get, you know, when you're too far away, you know, it doesn't quite pick it up.
And then you're getting the room sound as
you're
well.
You're getting a little bit of the room in. Yeah. You know, I did it with Corey. We did it in his office, and I thought it went really well. And I brought it on the road because my goal was I wanted to be able to set it up and do like an impromptu podcast in the middle of like a Diamond League meet. Like, oh, hey, this is, you know, the after event.
Oh, that would be, yeah, that'd be fantastic.
But, you know, I haven't quite got it done because if you're going to do that, what I'll probably have to do is like, okay, I'm going to get a bunch of beer. And get all the really fun guys. I'm just going to go in a room, and you just guys are just talking, and hopefully you can pick up everything properly, or figure out a way to hook something to my iPad that can pick up the audio, and do the mics or something.
Yeah,
you know, I think they're $50 or $60 a piece if you want to just clip something on somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Very low end. We're talking just
yeah, the very possible. Low end. Yes, yeah,
very
like
low.
Like end. That one actually, that microphone you're holding in your hand costs more than. I have a Yeti as well.
You do? Okay, so yes. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. That microphone costs more than that. So, like, I've doubled my price just with these. But these...
They actually make a really good headphone, just regular headphones.
Yes, yes.
I had a pair of those. I was like, oh, these things are pretty good. And they weren't, like, super expensive. They're not Beats expensive, but they were reasonably priced when I bought it. Uh-huh. So I was like, oh, okay, these are great.
Well, I think you should revisit this idea. It's a great idea. It takes it takes a little bit of investment and a little bit of time.
Yeah, but it's well worth it. What I'll probably do is I will, whenever I go on the circuit and we're just sitting around drinking beer or whatever, I'll just throw the Yeti on and say, okay, we'll just do an impromptu, and as long as you keep it clean and whatnot, then we can put it up there. Just because I just think that people like hearing about what you know professional shot putters are doing, what we're talking about when we're done. Because people don't really get into that world. They're like, what are the people like? Are they really nice? Or,
oh yeah.
Okay, I don't want to mess with your
no. Podcast. You're I'm going to keep all this. This okay. is fantastic. That's all we're doing is having a conversation.
Okay.
Here.
Yeah.
And I definitely want to know what shot putters are doing because I was one myself.
Okay.
I went to Western Illinois University.
Yeah.
Division I scholarship. I did that for quite some time.
Yes.
Yeah. You know that's what I did because I think you might know me as Jake Manning, but I had to pick up my last name, Feuerbach.
Okay.
So I'm Al Feuerbach's nephew.
Oh, okay. Yes.
So that's why I'm very aware of you because I remember being in high school getting track and field news, seeing Rhys Hoffa's name all over the place. So I'm a little, this is very surreal to me that I'm now sitting at your couch at your gym and we're talking about shot putting. So
is one of my favorite topics. So,
one of your favorite topics.
Yeah.
You've been doing it for quite some time, but any training right now? So how's training going?
Training is a little tougher, you know, being 38 and trying to compete with Ryan and Joe and all these guys and just trying to figure out a way to make that ball go a few more inches further and figure out a way to do it consistently or more importantly, being able to be at my best on July 1. That's That's what everything I'm doing right now. That's what I'm training wise. So I've changed my technique a little bit, trying to sweep my leg a little higher out of the back of the ring. And right now I'm just trying to find that connection with the adjustment out of the back of the ring.
Yeah. And you've been, you say consistently, you've been consistently at the top of the shot putting world for a very long time.
Well, thank you.
Very long time. I think that that's just as impressive as anything else. Like that, that mm-hmm. to me, you're consistently, like when I found out, oh, he's from Georgia, maybe I can get a podcast with him. And then I started doing more research. I'm like, he's still going. And then even like, and then even when I talked to Corey, like Corey's like, oh, he's getting ready for the Olympics. I'm like, he's getting for the Olympics. I thought he was just doing this as a hobby. Like, I have to be very honest with you and straightforward because I'm out of the world of track and field and haven't really paid attention to that much. The fact that you're still going and still going after another Olympics is blows my mind right now. And I can't believe it. So like, what keeps you going? Like what, like physically, like, cause you said you're 38,
yeah.
But like all the pictures that I've seen of you on online, you've obviously, it's almost like you've retransformed your whole body. Like you are in great shape right now.
I've had to retransform my body. Originally I was I was in the 330 range for about 3 years.
Yeah, I've always known you as a bigger guy. So when I saw you got to pull up in the truck, I'm like, is that him?
Yeah. you know, I'm not 330. I'm about the goal is about 310. I'm about 314 right now. I need to drop weight. That's what happened. I dropped almost 22 pounds of weight from where I've been in the past. I just started seeing myself just as this fat, tubby guy spinning around the ring. And I'm just like, if I'm going to compete with these guys that are 300 pounds, I have to get faster. So I dedicated myself during the fall and just slowly worked my way down to 310. You know, I'm a little heavier right now because, you know, I had a salty dinner or something, you know, but you have to change with, you know, I have to change my body to make sure I am ready to compete with these guys. Cause I can't do it at 330 anymore. I have to be lighter. I have to change my training, you know, just everything has got to come together. And luckily I have a lot of experience with throwing. So I knew at 300 pounds, I was a lot faster, I was a lot stronger. But when you make that change, all of a sudden it starts changing your technique. So you've got to figure out how that works.
You don't have that mass behind the ball anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. So I like being a little leaner. I mean, I'm going to get a lot leaner once I'm done after this year, you know, potentially going to retire. That's probably more up to my manager in terms of if he's going to try to keep me around or if I'm still motivated to do this. And you spoke to like what keeps me going for the, after 2012, I went in 2013, I had the automatic buy to go to the World Championship. So that stuck me around that year. And I hurt my knee that year. I was like, you know, after this year, I should just let it go. And as I started throwing, I, you know, slowly started getting a little bit better. I'm like, you know, this is not too bad. And in 2014, I said, okay, if I win the Diamond League this year and give myself an automatic buy for 2015, then I might as well stick around for 16. And a lot of miracles happened. You know, Christian, what looked like he was going to be unbeatable that year, he got hurt early. Ryan got hurt a little bit early. So you took out all the guys that were way better than me, and they pretty much are. I'm not kidding myself thinking, oh yeah, I'm as good as those guys. No, they're by far better. But Joe was really young at that time, so he wasn't quite as experienced as he is now. So my experience throughout the year, so I just kept piecing together meet after meet, winning when I needed to win, knowing when to back off, and I won the Diamond League. It kept me around to 2015. Went to World Championships in Beijing, finished fifth or whatever. I mean, when I get to the major, I know what to do. And that's why I'm here. So I'm like, well, I made it to 15. What's another year of training to see what happens in 16? You know, if I don't make the team, it's not a huge loss. It would, you know, I feel a little bad, but I'm trying to do everything I possibly can to give myself the best opportunity to throw against the best throwers in the world. That's what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, and to just to make the Olympic team,
yeah,
you know, at a juncture like this, has got to be an accomplishment in itself. You know, and that, and to be throwing against the best in the world. And it's always funny. I don't think people understand necessarily like the predicament of athletes like yourself. Like there's not a lot of attention on your sport except once every 4 years.
Yeah.
You could literally win the world championships for 3 years and then an Olympic year, you, something happens or you don't get a gold. And all of a sudden people don't think of you. I'm like, ah, it's not as good as this guy. that's a weird thing about this sport.
It really is. Because in 2007, I won the world championship in Osaka. So in 2008, you know, people were like, okay, maybe you could do something. And then I got six in 2008. it was almost like I didn't do anything at all.
Yeah.
It was crazy. I was like, well, you know, I'm still world champion. You know, I still did, it just, everything went away. So like in 2012, I was super happy to go into those Olympic Games as not the guy. Mm-hmm. I really liked that, just to be able to focus on coming here and throwing and figuring out what I need to do. That was awesome. And I feel like this year I have that same opportunity. You know, Joe Kovacs is the world champion. People aren't even looking at me. People like, oh, he's 38. He's washed up. There's no way this guy's going to be able to make it. And I'm not, don't go softly into the night, fight on, fight on. That's kind of like my mantra. It's like, yeah, I could just go there and be the, okay, hey, I went to the,
I made an Olympic team.
But my goal is like, I'm trying to win. I'm trying to put myself in a position. Cause I still know what I need to do. It's just a question of, can I get there?
Yeah, and it's a matter of inches when you get to your level.
Yes.
Of competing. It's such a matter of inches. Like, there's many Olympics where between sixth and first, we're talking 6 inches.
Yes.
Like, it's that ridiculous of one throw one way, and it's almost like a level. There's also a little bit of like superstitious, like a routine. If somebody's routine is off because of some small thing, like, it completely changes, they could be the best in the world, and then all of a sudden they're sixth on this one day.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, what are some things routine-wise that you like to do, that you like to keep with, especially on competition day?
Well, for me, it's the small routines of, making sure every time I get in the ring, I chalk up, make sure I chalk everything. It doesn't matter if I need it or not. I need to chalk. That's part of the routine. Entering the ring in a, directly through the back, or walking all the way around and entering through the right side of the ring. Just something crazy like that.
Oh, yeah, there's a certain side.
There's a certain side that I always enter the ring at.
There's a mark, if the circle where the screws are, or where it's recessed, if there's a certain crack that's there, like, oh, normally when I look down, it's smooth, but there's a crack there. Like, just weird things.
In 2012, in Turkey, I made the World Indoor Championship team, and we go there, and I'm used to throwing on a perfectly square back, and all of a sudden they change the ring to a diamond. That completely threw me, throwing on a diamond ring. And you wouldn't like, well, what does that mean? It's like, I set my turn on a square. Mm-hmm. So the diamond, all of a sudden that square is moved and turned the other direction. It totally messed with the way I entered the ring and we had a psychologist there. We took chalk. It's like, this is the corner right here, Reese. And from the outside of the ring, this is where you got to enter. And, I think I threw, 2155 over 70 feet, and usually that would get sacker or really close to winning, and I got fourth in that meet. It was just one of those crazy meets, but little stuff like that messes with your mind and routine and how you're used to seeing things is crazy. Like being in a, seeing the arc of the track could throw you off on how you enter the ring. Like if you're used to just a background of nothing, and all of a sudden you're on the infield of a track, and all of a sudden you see the turn. It's like, okay, well, that, I might mess with it. It has before, and it's just little things to overcome.
And some meets, they're running races while you're throwing.
Exactly, that kind of stuff, yeah.
And if there's a false start, if you're in a windup, especially as a spinner, if you're in a turn, a gun goes off, like, just those little things.
It, you got to learn how to block that out. Stay at practice, they're doing the heptathlon, decathlon, and just hearing, not used to hearing music playing while I'm throwing. Usually it's just like dead silent. I'm focused on what I'm doing. And, seeing kids walking around the rings, it's crazy. It's like, you don't usually notice that. In a meet, I have blinders on. I don't care. I don't even see the people in the stands. Because, you're used to that environment. But in practice, there's a specific way I do things. And it's dead silent. No one talks. I take a throw, whatever. And, just breaking that routine is just sometimes unnerving.
Yeah. Well, what's your training routine? Do you is it very exact every day? Like, take me through like today or this week or what you got.
So, this is a meet week. Mm-hmm. So everything is speed, keep it reasonably light. This is early on. So we still put a little bit of weight, in terms of weight in there, but the volume's way down. We usually do a bench on Tuesday. Wednesday is just exploding, do ball throws overhead, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Today, do some sled pushes, some easy twisting exercises, nothing really crazy. And then after the meet, I'll go do a squat workout. On a non-meet day, we do a little bit heavier bench. do some kind of deadlift, banded deadlift, just working on a little bit of explosiveness there. Cleans really hurt my back. Snatches sometimes hurts my shoulder. So it matters how my body feels in terms of if we're going to add that into our workout. We'll just supplement it with something else. And then we'll hit another squat on Friday. And usually that gives me enough time to recover for my Tuesday practice. Mm-hmm. So my legs are, you know, the legs are pretty much the engine of the throws. Yeah. So I want to make sure they're as recovered as I possibly can make them before I have to throw. That's why we do it like in a couple of weeks before I go to Kansas, we're doing squat workout on Thursday. So it gives me my normal amount of rest so that on Monday and Wednesday before I leave to go to Kansas, I'm ready to go. Mm-hmm. You know, stuff like that. You just got to be smart right now, you know, just trying to figure out everything right now.
Absolutely. Like how many times do you throw in like a day?
I only throw one time a day. And I probably take around 20, 25 throws. Early on in my career, I was throwing, it seemed like all the time, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, maybe punch something in there on a Sunday, you know, just, I was just trying to learn the technique, make sure I was a bit more proficient. Like in high school, I threw every other day. Sometimes mm-hmm. it was three, sometimes it was four times a week. It's just whatever it was on the schedule. Like one day you throw, one day you're off, and it nearly killed me, you know, to be honest. But that's what was required to learn the technique. I was really young. I needed to learn specific positions. And you can't learn them unless you're doing it.
Exactly.
So our high school coach, he sacrificed a lot of time with his family to go out there and watch me take, you know, 40 or 50 throws in a practice until I got it right kind of deal. And his name's David Bukovic. And, you know, I don't think I could be here if I didn't have that foundation. Then, of course, Don Pabbitt being my collegiate coach, kind of refining what I've learned in high school to make me the thrower I am today.
Well, you just touched on high school and throwing and stuff mm-hmm. like that. You know, obviously you're a big, strong guy.
Yeah.
And usually big, strong guys end up playing football.
Because yes.
That's where it is. How do you end up being a shot putter? Like, how does that happen?
The way I became a shot putter, I'm a realist when it comes to my athletic ability. So at a young age, I thought I was going to be a football player. Big, strong. I was one of the fastest kids in my community. And lucky for me, when I got to high school, we went from a 3A school, which is kind of big, to a 4A school, which is pretty big. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, I had to start playing Atlanta schools and, you know, Warner Robins and all these other bigger schools. And all of a sudden, I started seeing my junior year. It's like, man, these guys are really big. These guys are even faster than me. Because when you're in that little small pond, mm-hmm. I'm the man. I'm like, I'm dominant. I'm going to go. If this is football, I'm going to be the greatest college football player ever. And then all of a sudden, I start seeing, comparing myself against other defensive linemen, what I'm seeing on tape, and me going against, you know, Division I talented kids. I'm like, you know what?
Guys that are genetic freaks.
Genetic
freaks. 6'4".
6'4".
Just came out at, like, 280,
yeah,
jacked.
Yeah, so I started seeing that, and I'm like, you know, I need to readjust my expectation of, you know, I thought, you know, I'm going to go to Miami, I'm going to go to Florida State, I'm going to go to some big university and be the man. Mm-hmm. And after seeing that, I was like, you know what, you know, I might be lucky if I go to Division II. You know, I'm big, I'm pretty, you know, 5'11", it's not super big compared to a guy that's 6'4". Mm-hmm. I have the speed, but just, I was 240. And these guys at freshman are 260 pounds and fast as a cat. So I'm like, I can't compete with that. So when I got into throwing, it was my junior year. I started getting good at it. And, you know, I started comparing myself to these other guys who go into meets and seeing them. And I'm beating them. I'm like, okay, obviously I have some talent. We'll see what happens. And at the end of my junior year, I threw 58.8, you know, the University of Georgia got a hold of me and said, hey, we'd like to offer you a full scholarship, you know, after that year. I'm like, obviously, I must be really good if I'm getting offers here. That is kind of the reason why I got into throwing is, you know, I wanted to go to a pretty good university. I didn't want to go play football at a small school that I had no, like, you know, if I want to do something, I'm going to want to be really good at it.
You want to be the best at it.
I want to be the best. And, you know, coming to Georgia, Don had a great reputation of really developing talent in the throws. So I'm like, hey, I'm going to go there and see what happens. And I just wanted to be just a good collegiate thrower, get my degree in health and physical education and become a school teacher and teach kids to do PE. But,
you know, be Kenny Powers, rest of your
life. Be Kenny Powers. And, you know, I guess the rest is a little bit more history.
Yeah, obviously. Well, what was the turning point? Like when you first got to college, like, well, you know, like what was the thought process? Like, hey, this might be a little bit more than me just doing this during college? Like, what was the turning point for that? What was the light bulb that switched off?
Well, in college, it was my junior year, went to the Olympic trials. I finished sixth. And that was very eye-opening. Mm-hmm. I'd never been done an Olympic trial. I've been like the U.S. Nationals the year before, made the final, finished eighth. And then the next year was the Olympic trials in 2000. And went there and went through qualifying. I qualified. Oh, okay. That's pretty good. Very excited. Called my high school coach. Hey, I qualified for the final at the Olympic trials. And then I finished sixth, beat some pretty good kids. Not great guys, but I beat some pretty good people. Got close to, you know, CJ Hunter, you know, ended up not going. And then John Cadena. So essentially I moved up to five. I was like, maybe there's a chance I can make an Olympic team. Let me just keep working at this. And then the next year, made it to the Warren University Games. This is back when they used to fund that. And, you know, that was like my first team. I went over to Beijing, competed on internationally. Okay, this is pretty nice. It's kind of, that's like the stepping stone. You make the Warren University Games, and then all of a sudden you go to Pan Ams, and then you start making the major teams, like making the Worlds. It wasn't until 2003, like 2 years out of college, that I'd be like, okay, maybe there's a chance I could be an Olympian. Because previous to that, I was getting my butt kicked by Adam Nelson. I think Kevin Toth was still throwing. Andy Bloom was still around. You know, we had...
Yeah, there was like three guys there that early 2000s just dominated.
They were very dominated.
But you were always in the mix.
You
were always in the mix.
So it wasn't until I made the World Championship team in 2003 that I was like... Yeah, because I think I finished third at Nationals, and that's what you got to finish to make the Olympic team. Like, hey, if I can finish third again, I could be an Olympian. Mm-hmm. And I went to, that next year in 2004, got a silver at the World Indoor Championships, beat Adam, is me and Christian on the team, Adam and John, beat both of them there. I was like, these guys, yeah, I could beat these guys. And you know, Adam had a great throw at the Olympic trials and beat me, and I got second. So I was like, this is it. Yes. So that was kind of that journey, but it took a while because...
Even to that point, it took you almost making an Olympic team to think of this is gonna, I was going to do.
Yeah, I mean, it took until at least 2003. I mean, in 2002, when I went to the U.S. Nationals, like, maybe I can hang with these guys. That was the thought process. The idea of beating them never crossed my mind because, you know, I idolized John Cadena. Adam Nelson, one of my biggest idols. And coming up in the ranks was Christian Cantwell in 2003. That was his first year. I was like, okay, I got to beat this guy too. And in 2004, Christian was ranked number one in the world and didn't make the Olympic team because he had thrown 22 meters like four times. The first four meets of the year threw 22 meters and won the final. But he didn't make the Olympic team and hurt his ankle. But it's just like, you know, I just being realistic to myself, it's like these are the people and they are a lot. All three of those guys are 72-foot shot putters, 22-meter guys. And at that time, my best was 69 feet. Mm-hmm. So... Yeah, and all, if you look on paper, there's no way I should have made that team. Mm-hmm. So that's why I just keep myself realistic and say, these are where my goals need to be. And slowly, you know, you start progressing and getting better and you start understanding the game of being a professional. Because there's no manual saying, hey, this is how you become a professional. This is what you got to do. And Don did a great job of saying, okay, if you want to be ranked in the top 10 in the world, these are the marks consistently that you have to throw. So that's what I went to. It's not going out there and throwing 69 feet every time you pick up a ball. It's more like throw 67, 68, average around 68, and you'll be top 10. Hmm. Yeah.
Well, what were the adjustments that you had to make to get to that point when you realized that that was a viable goal? What were the adjustments you had to make in yourself and your training?
Well, I had to train myself to be able to throw in June, July, August, and September. And because when you start training, you're starting in October. There's a long time between getting to June and July, you know, those months. And that's where really June is when you make the teams. July is where you make your money. August is where the majors are. And September is where you pick up the back end money. So those are like the four most important months of throwing. Mm-hmm. Everything up to those months really doesn't mean anything. It's just kind of testing, seeing where you're at kind of stuff. Those months, but you know, when I got to college, I'd never went past May, you know, and then, my first year as a freshman, you know, going to June, I was dead tired. We went to, you know, U.S. National or the NCAAs.
Yeah, because you're training hard. You're lifting heavy weights.
Lifting heavy weights, and
throwing and just everything that goes into detail. And then also you're traveling as well. So you've got to contend with all that. You know?
You know, the first time I got on a plane was my senior year in high school. So I'd never been on a plane. Ever. Never. I came from a family of six kids. So our traveling was kind of packed into our station wagon and the big topper with all the luggage. So we drove everywhere. I never took a plane anywhere. The first time I got on a plane was to go to Boston for National Scholastic. And it was unbelievable. Oh, this is what it's like to be on a plane. This is awesome. And, you know, then you go to college and, you know, you get to fly a little bit more and you're like, oh, this is really good. And you're training, throwing a 12-pound ball and then throwing a 16, you know, adding 4 pounds to that. Just physically being able to do that.
There's a lot of people that can't make that adjustment. And I was definitely one of those people for sure.
So that was something I had to learn how to do and then figure out how to throw in July after, like, you get to June. Like, oh, I worked my way to June. I can go to U.S. Nationals. I can make a team. And then you get in July and you die again.
Mm-hmm.
And, it took me, after I graduated from high school, like 5 years to learn how to physically get my body ready to throw in June, July, August, September. And that was the biggest thing. So it's just like you start creeping up a little bit, getting a little bit better in June. Like, I didn't break 70 feet in September until I was like almost 30. So I get you fit. Anytime I got, it's like, it didn't matter if I was doing great in August. By the time I got to September, they're like, he's going to go down. And he won't be able to do that well, just because the nervous system just starts shutting down. And then you slowly start training yourself, like figuring out, okay, this is what I have to do. This is how I need to back off my training even more than what you normally would do, so that the back end, your nervous system is going to be just completely wrecked by the time you get to September. Mm-hmm. That was the biggest thing I had to learn, because it's not when you're training from October to go to September, you know, you set your base earlier in the fall, but for the most part, it's just maintenance. It's not like, okay, I need to hit another, I got to be a 500 pound bencher in June or 500 pound bencher in July. No, it's more like, be a 360-pound bencher and be able to do it in such a way where your nervous system's not going to be completely killed if you do it. That's the kind of the way I gear my training. So that's what I had to learn. It was tough. It was some growing pains.
Yeah, because you're learning how to be a pro athlete now.
Exactly.
You know, if this is how – this is your income. And yeah. It's interesting. It's probably unique, and maybe you can explain it for me, like the idea of being – like a pro athlete at this level, like, you know, how you make a living at it. When my uncle did it, like, that's the only way that I know of, but like, that was during the time that all Olympic athletes had to be amateurs.
Oh yeah.
Like my uncle was a Carahoo, weightlifting boot shoe salesman.
Yeah.
And that's how he made his money, you know, but you know, there was a time of sponsorships and stuff like that. Like how does it work income wise at, you know, this day and age and at your level?
Well, right now, the USA Track and Field and IAAF, they only really allow you to have two sponsors. Mm-hmm. So you got to make sure they're paying you enough to make it worth your while. So for me, when I first started, I wasn't very good. So the New York Athletic Club and my mom had to beg. My mom called them up and said, hey, my son, just getting done with college, could you help him out? And they're like, well, all right, I guess. So they took me on and said, listen, we can't give you any money, but we'll let you be part of our club. We'll, you know, give you a singlet to wear in meets. And as long as you travel within the U.S., we'll reimburse you some of the money. I'm like, okay, that's great. I'll take whatever you give me.
Yeah.
And then I did that for about 2 years. And then I got my first sponsor in 2004. And that was after I got a bronze medal or silver medal at World Indoors. And that was with New Balance. Hmm. So I was allowed to have my New York Athletic Club insignia on my shirt, and then have just New Balance outfits and shoes. And I think they gave me $5,000 for an entire year of track and field, which isn't a lot. Obviously,
it's not a lot.
It's not a lot. But, you know, back then, you know, to set up, you know, how I was living, I lived in a house with five other guys for $150 a month. And I think, you know, it's probably a grand total of, with utilities, splitting them on the five guys, it was probably $200 a month. That's how you take $5,000 and make it work for an entire year of training.
I imagine it's probably around the university. You have access to the track, and then you can come and have access to the weight room. So you don't have to pay for those two things.
Yeah,
and then of course living's cheap and stuff like that, because there's obviously going to be people around that you can room with.
Yeah. So you know, living with those, and you know, the way I did it was I had enough money. I was still on scholarship at this time, so they paid for my tuition and they gave me a little bit of money for food, and I only got one good meal a day, and that was at the university, and everything else I had to George Foreman, go to Sam's and bulk up, you know, that kind of thing. Or put it on a credit card. I put a lot of stuff on a credit card. Mm-hmm. A lot of credit card debt during this time. But you just do that. Like, so what I would do is I take Tupperware. I had my lunch was one meal I got from the university. So I take Tupperware and sneak it inside the facility, the dining hall, and I just load up on stuff. You know, like, oh, this guy must be starving. He keeps taking so much food. Yeah. But I put it in Tupperware and then hide it in my backpack. And that's kind of how I survived for a year, because, you know, I didn't have enough money where I could actually go to the grocery store and buy food. So you make it work. So like at my house, I drank a lot of water because water is free.
Yes.
So I splurged on some, Dasani gallon of the liter and a half bottles. And I would use those for, you know, months on end. Just I would dump it out and I drank it all up, put more water in, and that's what I carried around. Like I didn't have enough money to go buy like Coke and you know, if I wanted milk, I'd have to wait and get it at the dining hall. So you learn how to live with barely anything. Like I didn't have money to go and hang out with my friends or do anything. So I worked at a place called Dial America, and I worked for 24 hours a week, and it got me about $230 a week of extra money that I could use to put gas in my car and maybe get a little bit of food, pay for rent. You know, you learn how to live with nothing. That's how you make it. And then eventually, after making it to the Olympic Games, so for 2 years, I just did that. I just lived off the university and whatever money I made at Dial America and then just trained. That was my life. That there was no, hey, I'm going to go to these exotic locations. It's just me staying around here. And then eventually making it to World Indoors, getting a medal. It gave me an opportunity to go over to Europe. That was in 2004. So I quit my job and I said, if I can't make enough money to survive for one calendar year so I could go and do this again, then I need to get away from this, because it's going to cost me more money to do track and field than it is that I'm ever going to make. And lucky for me, I had a decent outdoor season. I think I made $10,000, and that was enough money with the current lifestyle to be able to live on that for an entire year, to be able to do another outdoor season and make enough money to continue to train.
Well, what kept you going during those thin years? Like, you know, there's a lot of people that would have bailed very, like 6 months into that, and you did that for quite some time. What was the thing that kept you going?
It helped having, you know, Adam Nelson. He moved into the community. He moved it around and trained with me. So just seeing him, and it's like, you know, if I get a little bit better, I could be Adam. Cause you know, Adam previous to that, you know, he won, you know, silver medals in like three consecutive events. So he was living kind of the life, like, I think I could do that. And it wasn't that Adam was living this.
You know, was it the sense that you could see success so closely to you?
I could see, because, you know, I train with him.
Yeah.
And I see what he's doing and how close my training is matching him. And, you know, as I started getting better and I started beating him, that made me think, if he is making a living doing that, then I can do that too. Mm-hmm. Now, the key to that is you got to get medals.
Yeah.
And Adam had the medals, so yeah, they're, you know, he gets in every meet. He gets a lot of money to go to those meets. So me getting a medal at the World Indoors really helped a lot to make sure I got into meets, and they actually gave me like appearance fees. And that's really what, so I went from making 10 to making 80. Like, that was huge.
Obviously. So,
you know,
when you're stealing food out of a cafeteria, making $80,000 is a different world.
So I'm making 80 grand a year, and then all of a sudden, you know, I could buy my first car. Like, my first car we paid $5 for. And then the next car we paid $250 for. It was a Ford Escort, 1989 Ford Escort. And I drove that until the transmission literally blew up while I was going up a hill. So I splurged and spent $1,200 on a Ford Taurus. And
being very frugal. No,
yeah,
this
very
money could,
I didn't have any money. So
this money could go away very fast.
And I drove that for a while. It was like, it didn't have air conditioning. It didn't have a radio. you know, it didn't have anything great, but it had power windows, and it was comfortable. It was a little bit, going from Escort, which is pretty small, to a Taurus, Ford Taurus is pretty roomy, so I could actually fit comfortably in there. So when I have to drive, you know, 5 or 6 hours to go to North Carolina or something to go to a track meet, at least I'd be somewhat comfortable. It had, you know, better suspension. You know, there was a lot really good about it. And then eventually, that was when I was making 10, and then I made 80, and I was like, maybe this is time that I can spend $5,000. So I spent $5,000 on a Isuzu Trooper. Mm-hmm. That lasted, and they got it from Minnesota rental car, and it blew up. So there goes $5,000 down the. But I, by some miracle, this thing made it to a dealership, and I worked a deal with them, and I paid five, and they gave me three on the trade in. So it gave me enough money for to buy like a Nissan Altima, the first car I ever had that didn't have like 150,000 miles on it. It actually had like 10. When I did that, I mean, I was making payments on it, obviously, but that was when I was making 80. I was like, you know what? I am rich. To me, it was like, I am a rich man. Like I can go out and actually go to a restaurant and like buy food that, you know, like go to a place that costs $50 for the meal. I could actually do that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I could pay for cable. That was huge. You know, I mean, things.
No, I'm not laughing at you. I love this. This is what I want to hear. Yes.
So, you know, these things like that was, I mean, I remember when I could pay for cable, I was just like, oh, this is great. And, you know, I have ESPN. I can watch, I don't have to go somewhere mm-hmm. and watch it at someone else's house. Like I have, you know, I went from when I first started out, I had a TV that was black and white and it was like 12 inches. It was super tiny. Mm-hmm. And I got it at the Kroger for $19. Because I wanted to have a TV in there, and I didn't have cable or anything, but at least I could pick up the station, you know, rolling the thing. It didn't have the turn. It was like you scroll it down like a music thing.
Yeah, like the old AM, FM radio.
So you're like, you have to pull it just right to get it to be clear enough to watch something.
And you're like, maybe I can just a little bit. Oh, no, I missed it. So,
and yeah. Like I remember buying my first TV for like $200, and it was like a 36-inch TV. I'm like, I'm living the life. And then, you know, after that, you know, after I made that Olympic team, I don't think I ever had to worry about like, hey, am I going to be able to make enough money to do this? Because, you know, I kept making other teams and just the ball started rolling. And I went from being, you know, the number 36th ranked athlete in the world to all of a sudden being in the top 10. And then all of a sudden that was in 2004. In 2005, I got ranked number 2 in the world. Once I got to number 2 in the world in 2005, that was it. You know, I was making six figures a year from that point to now, you know, like it changed everything. And then, you know, I won the world championships. That was the turning point. And then once you've got like a world championship, like I won a world indoor in 2006 and then backed it up with a world outdoor in Osaka in 2007, I was set. I never had to worry about money. I could actually, I think in 2007, that was when I finally could start saving money and put money away for the future, mm-hmm. which would, for me, it was like, that was a new idea because most of the time I just had to take my money and this is what I'm going to live on and whatnot.
Pay off that credit card debt.
Pay off credit. Yeah, that was a huge, in 2004.
Slow those phone calls down a little bit.
Yeah. In 2004, I remember when I made 80,000, I had close to $10,000 in credit card debt. I actually wrote a check for $10,000.
It's actually not that bad considering what some people are doing these days.
Yeah, but you know, to me, it's like...
Oh, yeah, I have the same thing. I have like a $2,000 balance on it right now. I'm freaking out about it.
Yeah, so. But, you know, writing a check for $10,000 saying, I'm never going to be in credit card debt ever again. And that's huge to be able to have that. Like, I own a car. I don't have credit card debt. Because, you know, I see, you know, how my parents are, and they, you know, always had credit card debt. They're just paying the minimums and just like, you know, I don't want to live my life where I'm always like wondering, I'm always going to have someone under someone's thumb. I wanted to be free. Like, hey, that's rich. If you're so rich, you're not in debt. You own everything.
Not owing anybody anything.
Not owing anybody anything. You just live your life. You're like, hey, I don't have to worry about it. And that's the way that's the way I'd like to continue to do things within my life. Just like if I put on a credit card, I immediately pay it off. I don't have credit card debt. I never do that kind of stuff, just because I see how it makes you think about it. And I want to take that away. I don't want to have to think about, hey, am I going to be able to pay this off?
Is that level of independence like what you've always sought for in a sense? Because like you're doing something that's very unique and it's by yourself. Like, yeah. I can't imagine like, you know, you could run and go work in an office, you know what I'm saying? And listen to middle management and stuff like that. Like, is that something you've always aspired to, is doing your own thing by yourself and not being independent, you know?
To be honest, I actually like being in a situation where I just have to just follow an order or a command of some kind. Being out, doing what I'm doing now is very uncomfortable for me, believe it or not. Like, I like the idea that if I want to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I can do that. I don't answer to anybody. I could just do that. Mm-hmm. But I really like the structure. Like, I wish I was more like my wife. She gets up in the morning and she has a purpose. I get up in the morning, I have a purpose, but it's
You have a pretty big purpose.
Big purpose, but it's a loose purpose. Like, sometimes I just find
defined myself. Defined by
yourself. Find myself, because when I get up in the morning, it's like, if I wanted to just like, I'm going to just mess around on the computer for an hour and a half, I could do that, and then I'll just go do something else. Like, I don't like days when I have off days, because what do I feel those days doing? So what I do is I write out a plan every day, just of things to do to fill a day.
Because, like, are you a big list guy?
I have to make a, when I don't make a list, I'm everywhere doing something stupid.
You don't feel like you've been pulled in a little bit.
Yeah, I would love to say, okay, I get up at 7 o'clock every day. I go have my breakfast. I'm dressed or whatever by 7:30. I'm cooking my breakfast, and then I'm out the door by 8 o'clock. And then I get to work. I'm get, you know, 8:30, 8:45. And then my next thing is I'm getting ready for class. Like, that structure really speaks to me. I don't know why, but I love that structure because it gives me this sense of purpose in terms of this is what you have to do. Whereas now it's like, okay, this morning I knew, okay, I have to get up. I need to have my breakfast done by 8 o'clock because I had a meeting at UGA to go look at some weights and stuff. And then I have practice. But I love that. Like, okay, I'm going to be at the track, I'd be at the gym by this time. I need to lift by this time. I need to make sure I'm done by this time so I can get my lunch. Tomorrow, I have to get up in the morning. I have one little meeting at 9 o'clock. And then the rest of the day, I can do whatever I want. And I struggle with, like, okay, well, what do I do?
Yeah.
It's like, usually before we, before we had a house cleaner, we have somebody that comes to clean our house. Before then, on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, those were the days where I cleaned my house because it gave me something to do. It gave me a purpose. And I had a time, like, I have to have it done by this amount of time. I knew exactly from the moment I pull out my broom to the moment I put the vacuum cleaner away, the exact time it takes me to clean the entire house. And I could plan for that. So it's like, okay, at 10 o'clock, I start cleaning my house by 11:30 or 12 o'clock, I'm done. I eat lunch. And that was like, that gave the purpose of the day. And then after that, it's like, well, I guess I go just play video games and wait to see. I hate that. I feel like I should be doing something every day because it's, you know, I see it from my parents. My dad gets up every day and go to work. And I guess it comes down with, like, you get this sense of guilt. Like, I have incredible amounts of freedom to do whatever. Mm-hmm. So
and there's almost a sense like, you know, somebody else is doing something, right?
Someone else is doing something.
And I think that it comes with, like, especially people that compete, that are athletes, they think about, like, somebody else is doing something right now and they're getting better than me. Or there's something, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Or because you're always looking towards that other person and you're like, oh, he's getting a full day in of working out and he's cleaning the house. Well, I'm going to do the same. You know?
Yeah, I'm going
to
do that. Yeah.
Yeah. You get that weird thing. But it's dumb. Like, no, cleaning the house doesn't get me to the goal I'm getting to. But there's that weird competitiveness that I think competitors and athletes have.
Yeah. You know, and I know that I can't lift all the time. So if I got up in the morning, I don't have anything to do, I could mess around till 4 o'clock and then I can just come in and then it only takes me an hour and a half, 2 hours of lifting. So I'm done by 6. And then I can go home and then I can start dinner. I mean, that is the complete day. It's like, what do you do from when you wake up to 4 o'clock? Mm-hmm. That is real. And that's why I kind of envy my wife, because she has an exact purpose. She gets up in the morning because she's going to work to go teach for kids that may not appreciate her, but she's going to work. And when she's done with that, then she's going to come lift and come hang out with me. So I feel like she is doing way more than I am in the course of a day. So I feel like I need to match that. But I make a whole lot more money doing, and I feel like I make a whole lot of money doing nothing. And she's working her butt off. And I make triple what she makes in a year. Mm-hmm. Like I go and do 3 track meets and I make as much money as my wife does for an entire year. And it's just like, well, I mean, I guess this is why I do. I mean, I want to be good at what I want to do, but it just makes you feel guilty a little bit.
And you got to do something with that guilt. You might as well use it somewhere.
I'm going to use it somewhere. And, you know, sometimes, you know, for them, as long as, you know, once I start training, then the purpose is there, you know, just making sure you stretch and do all those little things. But eventually, as you've done that for 20 years, you're like, boy, I really don't like stretching that much. But for it, that's what kind of gets a little crazy. It's like when I was in my 30s, you know, coming up, I didn't even notice I was doing it. It was like I was a machine. I just get up. I just all of a sudden I'm on the ground. I'm stretching. Now it's like I have to consciously think, well, it's 9:30. Okay, I need to start doing the stretching before I go to bed to make sure that when I wake up I'm not stiff as a board.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff. So that's letting me know, okay, you need to start getting out of this. If just doing those simple mundane things or somewhat, you got to put a little bit more energy into it. Whereas to them, it was just like I was on a mission. Like, I'm doing it. I'm downstairs. I'm getting the stretch bands. I'm doing everything I need to do. And now it's super hard because, you know, for the most part, I'm just like, I just want to go to bed. I don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that's happens. You're just like, why am I doing this again?
Yeah. Why am I doing it? Like, I've already got the medal. I've got a ton of medals. I've been successful for a really long time. And, you know, you just, I struggle with it, but I realize, I know like now it's easier because I'm like, I have a mission. I know exactly what I want to do. I want to try to win the Olympic gold. If I can do it, great. If I don't, but I have to make sure because I
got to leave it all on the table.
I don't have another year. That's why I look at it. I don't have another year. Like if I mess this up now, it's not like I can come back next year and fix it. This is like, it'll take you another 4 years before you get another chance to get a medal. And I don't know if I have another 4 more years in me, so I better get it right now. So like this year, usually I do 20 meets a year. This year I might be doing 9.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm cutting well over half. I might even do 7 just because I'm like, I don't want to travel to, like, I don't want to go to China and do a track meet. I don't want to go over to Europe and do a track meet. I'm just going to stay in the U.S., train here, do the meets I need to do just in terms of sharpening my technique, and that's it. And just focus on the one most important meet. And as long as I get that right, everything I've done up to this point makes perfect sense and it'll be fine.
So, you know, I don't want to like dwell on too much because you've got to focus right now where you want to be here in a couple months. But like, what's the plan afterwards? Have you given any thought to that?
My goal is to continue to make the Hoffa Throws Academy the most successful throws academy in the world. And that, you know,
yeah. Talk about the work you're doing now because this fascinates me. It's a fantastic facility.
Thank you.
Anybody that's a shot putter or a thrower in this area should be coming here. Should be contacting you. Anybody in the sound of my voice, and anyone, you know, even as far north as Richmond or Tennessee, should be finding their way down to Georgia. This is an unbelievable facility for sure.
Well, thank you very much. And I feel like I'm just getting started. We started last year. And I think I had 7 total athletes that came and worked with them, and they got better and whatnot.
Ranging in age group.
We're talking, the youngest athlete I coached was probably 11,
mm-hmm.
and they came a couple times, and the oldest would be a high school senior.
Yeah, which it's essential, especially, you know, when we're talking about the throws,
yeah.
to start very young, because very young. I felt like I could have been a good hammer thrower, but I'm starting it at 18.
Yes.
When the Russians, the Ukrainians have been doing it since they were 6.
Yes. So primarily I'm just focusing on the shot and disc, and I feel like I'm getting better at the disc. I've been doing shot for so long, it's a little bit easier to do shot. And just trying to make the kids better. I know the way I would want to train somebody, and right now I can only do a quarter of that because, you know, I don't have a lot of time. And the kids that come in, they're just happy to like, hey, well, I'm just happy that you're just here for one day a week or whatever. But, you know, the way we run it is I do it Monday, Wednesday, and I usually sometimes have a Friday, and then we do a Sunday. So about 4 days a week, and for 1 to 2 hours, and on the weekend, 3 hours is usually what we do. And I've had a lot of, I feel like I've gotten pretty good, a lot of success. Most of the kids in the discus have improved around 20 feet. in the shot. It's more like 7, 8, 10 kind of feet. So everyone's getting better, and I'm just happy that they're supporting me. That's number one. When I'm finally done and get to do this 24 hours a day, then we go to the next gear, where the way it will be done is you come in for one primary, or hopefully 2 to 3 primary days where you're doing nothing but the skill, and then you have supplementary days where you come in and do drill stuff, just working on the small nuances of whatever technique you want to do, glide, spin, discus stuff, whatever. And then we're going to slowly start incorporating like a little bit of weight throw, a little bit of hammer throw. I'm not going to do javelin because I'm not a javelin guy. Sorry, guys. But, you know, we're just start slowly, was I like helping them improve their portfolio, because I want kids that come here, I want this to be like the grooming station to get them to college. And when they get to college, they can continue to improve. So I just want to make sure they have solid fundamentals. That's number one. The footwork, everything's in the right place. They know how to, at least if they're spinning, they know how to work the technique to accelerate the ball. And when they go to college, hopefully set them up to throw at 16. Because, you know, if you don't have the, because I think when I got into college, I didn't have all the best fundamentals. So it was, you know, a year or two to learn the like the proper position.
You're learning the fundamentals. You're also dealing with a weight change in the ball, you know, which is something that you should be preparing themselves.
Yeah, and it shows, like, if you go from a 12 to a 16, any deficiencies in your technique will be blaring when you throw a 16.
Yep.
So the things you could have got away with a 12, you cannot. You can't muscle a 16.
Nope.
Maybe Christian, but he is the only person that could actually muscle the ball out there. Everybody, us mortals, you have to use technique, and that's what I want to teach them. I want them to. I don't want it to be just robots and say you put your foot here, you do this, and they have absolutely no understanding of what they're doing in terms of, well, I put my foot there. You know, why do I need to put my foot there? And just try to educate them on the throws. That is my whole goal. So when you change the weight, they're like, okay, if I hit the middle this particular way, it allows me to accelerate my right side of my body faster, and all I have to really do is extend my arm, and the ball's going to fly. Now, if you're just like, I get in the middle of the ring, and I'm just going to go nothing but upper body, yeah, you might be able to get away with a 12. You put that with a 16, and then the ball's going to, it's going to bite you back.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the kind of fundamentals I want to teach the kids when they're throwing with me, is just understanding what the positions are supposed to do. And while they're doing it, help them to manipulate the technique to make the ball go somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was just talking with Corey, a business partner, I guess.
He's the reason I have a lot of the stuff I have here. They came to me last year and they're like, hey, we'd like to build you an indoor throws facility. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm not done throwing yet, but okay, well, if you want to do it. And over the course of a month, all of a sudden, we have an indoor throwing area.
It's great.
It's awesome. And then I'm like, well, I guess I need an outdoor area too. And they're like, okay, well, we'll build you. Like, I just threw ideas at them, and they're like, we'll build that. And they just go out and build it. And, you know, they built 2 rings out there for outdoor throwing. It's just like, wow. And, you know, Corey's like, I'm investing in you. And he's like, you don't pay for any of this. We'll take care of it. And then as long as you stay with us, don't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But they're like, but they're just,
why would you?
Yeah,
you basically have access to the 2 outside, and then you've got probably another one by the net, and then you get one indoor.
Yep.
And then of course you have 2 discus rings.
Yep.
So why would you go anywhere else?
There's really no need to go anywhere. I'm really lucky. This is ultimately where I'm going to be. This is where I'm going to be training kids. And it's not just in throws. I mean, my goal is to teach people how to lift and to sprint and make them fast, athletic. We're not just teaching you to throw. We want the complete throwing athlete. And it carries over, especially in high school, it carries over to football, carries over to baseball or whatever.
Like I was talking to Corey, like athletics has become so specialized.
Yeah.
That like if a kid wants to be, say, I want to be a college football player, he has to be coming to facilities like this and training extra and in the off season and during season and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Some places where they can do some kettlebells and medicine balls, training, TRX traps, power cleans, snatch, all that. So they need to be coming to places like this to get ready for it.
That's the ultimate goal. I know it's an investment in your kid's future.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe that kid isn't going to be the next Brady or whatever, but this is at least going to give them a chance, because there are some athletes out there that are just freakish in terms of just their ability level. You give them a weight, and all of a sudden they put on 30 pounds of muscle, and they've done nothing. And sometimes there's some big kids that have to work. And I'm one of those guys. I had to work. I didn't come out of high school and college as the biggest, strongest guy. I had to work year in and year out to get the strength to be able to compete with these guys. And it helps to have someone who comes in. If I was just naturally strong my entire life, I may not understand what really needs to be done in terms of getting kids to where they want to be. It's in a way, it's never too late to gain the strength and the ability and just whatever in what you're doing.
Mm, absolutely. And, you know, you've got a fantastic facility here. And like I said, anybody that's, you know, there's really not a place like this. Like if a kid's interested and like, hey, I might be a collegiate shot putter, like where would, this would be the place to go for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Know? That's the,
there's not another goal. Place like this. I don't think.
Well, I mean,
there may be a few.
There's a few, there's a one in was it Marietta? There's a throw one deep with Mike Judge, who's mm-hmm. been a huge supporter of Hoffa-Thos Academy and me back to him. He's really the one that kind of gave me the idea, like maybe there's a way for me to do this and dedicate my life to teaching kids to throw. And he's been a big supporter. He's been a big fan of mine since I started throwing at the University of Georgia. He's an alum of the University of Georgia, so he just kind of knew who I was. But he's got his own throwing academy or club up in Marietta. So basically, the way I look at it, my territory is on the east side of 85, and he's going towards Atlanta. Mm-hmm. He's north, I'm south. But it's, you know, within a small area, there's tons of kids. And my goal is just to get all those kids from Gwinnett, basically Gwinnett County, and get them all coming to my academy and working and getting them better. And hopefully a lot of the parents will invest in their kids so that they can have other options. Because, you know, with football and the concussion studies and all that kind of stuff, yeah. Maybe there are some parents who are like, hey, I know in the state of Georgia, it's very important that you play football. You may not get a girlfriend because they only like football players kind of deal. But they want to believe that safety is number one. Why don't you try throwing? You're pretty good at that. And they put them in my hands and I teach them how to throw. And all of a sudden they get a scholarship to go throw at a great university. That's my goal.
Yeah. That's a wonderful goal, and you're definitely going about it for sure. We're getting pretty close, and there's okay. certain topics that I there's quick questions, but I definitely want to get to the topic that I always get to in all my interviews.
Okay.
And we've gone back and forth on it and stuff like that, but I always ask people that I talk with about success. What is it to you? How do you define it? Is it attainable? You know, and do you feel like you've attained it, or do you think it's possible? Like, just what are your overall general thoughts about success?
I think success is almost whatever you want it to be. So for me, success is just continuing to make progress in whatever you're doing, just getting a little bit better. That's success to me, because success isn't just, okay, I want to be on top of the mountain. Sometimes it's just going from the very bottom where you're on the ground, just being on the mountain in a way, that's creating success. Because as you start making your way up the ladder of success in a way, there are little successes all the way there. It's not all like, I can't go from the bottom all the way to the top, you know, quick. I've never done that. I've always, you know, climbed the mountain. Sometimes it's a little slippery and you got to get a little suction cup pans to make it up that particular section. But for me, success is just little victories every day. So just, you know, if it could be for me for a little while, like when I was getting off the path of what I needed to do in 2015, success was me. It was just, if I could go 2 weeks and get proper sleep and do the proper amount of stretching and seeing my physical therapist consistently within a 2-week period, that was success to me. Because, you know, you start moving away, you're like, oh, I just don't want to do it anymore.
And just getting it in.
Just getting it in and just doing it, that was success. Or, you know, there was a point where I hurt my knee, just throwing 65 feet again. That was going to be success. I remember, like, I got stuck at throwing, you know, 64 feet for 3 months almost. And then all of a sudden one day I go out there and I throw 65. That was, to me, that was like a turning point. It's like, this is it. I finally am succeeding. This is success to me. And this is while I've already thrown 73, you know, 60, throwing 65. Why is that so? But when you fall out, when you feel like you can't do it again, and all of a sudden you do it, that's a huge success. So that's kind of the way I look at it.
Okay. Well, and how do you deal with failures?
Probably very miserably. failures are sometimes they can be very motivating, but you know, in 2008, I was supposed to win the Olympics. I'd won everything up to that point, and then I go to the Olympic Games and finish sixth. That was really hard, and luckily, I have a very good wife in Renata, and just her being there and saying, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, you're still really good at what you do. You can still make it. And you just kind of fall back on that, you know, when I go to a meet and I throw really, really bad and I'm like, you know, why am I doing this? Especially last year, I went to Pre and I think I had four or five consecutive meets where I threw 70 feet. And last year, I think I threw 64. And I was just like, that's it. I should stop throwing. I'm not good anymore. You know, so I kind of get down on myself, but later on I'm just thinking, you know what, hey, you're just a little older, and look, you know, some other, you know, external factors, like I did a meet in Doha, didn't give myself enough time to recuperate, to get ready for that meet. That's why you did it. It wasn't because you didn't have the ability to throw well. It's just you didn't take into account how traveling 14 hours to Asia, in a way, was going to have an effect on your body. So just being realistic that, you know, whatever it is your goal is, and if for some reason you don't make that goal, don't just say, oh, that's it. Just, oh, I'm towels in. I'm gone. I'm giving my shoes to the next kid I see, kind of thing. Just realize, yeah, you're still just as good as you need to be. You just got to be realistic.
Was that the most important lesson you learned from your failures?
Yes, that is by far the most important lesson. I think that's what keeps me in this, is like, you can't just look at the times when you fail as that's it. You just got to look past it and say, okay, that was just one instance. Let's, if this is where you're at, then let's just be better the next time you throw. And that's the way I look at it. Like, I threw 64 and then I come back and throw 67 the next meet. It's like, okay, I'm back on the horse. Okay, I'm back. I'm right where I need to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have a little bit of time and a couple quick questions that I want to get in, just because in research and stuff like that of everything. In researching you, the thing that pops up is a speed Rubik's cube.
Yeah.
Speed cubing is a word. Tell me about that and how you found out that was a thing, that you can solve a Rubik's cube extremely fast, and the parameters of that. Like, that's just unusual, and I feel like I'd be remiss if I at least didn't ask the question about it.
Well, the Rubik's cube came about, I mean, I'd played with it as a little kid, but not really seriously looked at it like, I want to solve this. It was my junior year in college, and I just happened to be on a bus, and I saw a kid. His name was Pinosan. That's the only reason I know his name is I found this kid. I hunted him down at the University of Georgia. I saw him on the bus. He was doing it, and I was like, I want to do that. So that day, I went to Walmart, and I bought I think it was like a $5.99 Rubik's Cube, and I started doing it and trying to figure it out. It took me 3 months to finally solve it, but it fascinated me. I like to challenge myself with things that I know I'm not going to be a master at, because it always keeps me mentally stimulated to continue to try to get better. Just, you know, trying to reach that little bit of success. If I could just solve it 1 second faster than I did the previous, then I'm getting better, kind of idea.
Well, what's a fast time?
For me, I was like, you know, the first thing I try to do is like, can I break 5 minutes? And then a really fast time, there's some guys out there that are way, way better than they're 11, 10 seconds. And I'm in that minute. If I'm really hustling, maybe I can get in my 38, 39 seconds. But my goal originally was like, hey, I want to do this for a little bit and get good enough to do an actual competition. I did one. Mm-hmm. And my goal was just to make it out of the pool play, I guess, in a way. So I think we had 20 something guys, the top 15. And I finished 17, so I was two away from making it to the next round. Really, you know, just I really worked hard to try to do it. But I actually PR'd at that competition. But I needed something to distract my mind. Also, in competitions, I get, you know, caught when I was younger looking at everybody else, like, oh, look how far that guy throws, that kind of thing. And what I would do is I would sit on the sidelines in between throws, and I just do the Rubik's Cube, not even focus on anybody, just focus on this. And then my name gets called up. I put the Rubik's Cube down and throw.
Which I'm sure people that are spectators or people, coaches that are looking around, that's got to be the most unusual thing ever, is seeing a big guy solving, like, yeah. you have very big hands. And yeah. I'm sure the cube is very small and you're twisting it around. Yeah. Solve it, get up, throw almost 70 feet. I'm yeah. sure that is probably the most impressive thing to see if you're just a spectator, you're sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah, I'm sure they're just like, what is that kid doing? He must be weird. Why is he doing Rubik's Cube? But it's just something that I picked up. I mean, when I first started learning, everyone was like, why are you doing this? You're never going to solve a Rubik's Cube. And I'm like, every day I'm getting a little bit better. I'm learning something new.
Well, I'm sure in those lean years, it was probably a lot of entertainment that you could
that
fill.
Was a, you could, you, I mean, when I just graduated from college, you know, if I wasn't at Dollar America where I was doing credit card applications, mm-hmm. mortgage refinancing stuff, I was taking the application. I wasn't doing the refinancing. But yeah, I would spend hours and hours doing that. And I had a, my parents for Christmas one year, they got me a PlayStation, a Sega. So I had a few games. So I played Sega and did the Rubik's Cube. Mm-hmm. And when I was, or later on, I was doing more Rubik's Cube than playing Sega because it was more entertaining because I was learning something instead of just sitting there mundanely playing a game. So
yeah, not all the Sega games were all that great.
Yeah, that's right.
I had one as well. It was okay.
Yeah.
You know, Nintendo was the better one, I'd say. But anyways, yeah, it's very interesting. Did you say that? But anyways, we're at the end here. So
yeah.
Please give all of your information about how people can follow you on social media, how they can find okay. about, you know, Throwing Academy and just even the gym that you and Corey, you mm-hmm. know, work with and stuff like that.
So you can find Corey at CoreyBlendTraining.com. You can find me at HoffaThrows.com. Everything I have is HoffaThrows, so it's at HoffaThrows. My Instagram is HoffaThrows. My email address is HoffaThrows@CoreyBlendTraining.com. Mm-hmm. So everything's HoffaThrows. If you remember HoffaThrows, you can generally find me. If you literally type Google HoffaThrows, you can. It's no problem. And apparently they have my phone number on there, so that makes it easy too. So you can find, as long as you know HoffaThrows, at HoffaThrows on Twitter, HoffaThrows on Instagram, even on YouTube, HoffaThrows. Mm-hmm. You know, everything's HoffaThrows for me. And email is HoffaThrows@CoreyBlendTraining.com. So if you need to email me, you can find me there.
Well, Reese, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy training schedule yeah. and your work day and everything like this to sit down and talk to me. If I would have told 16, 17-year-old Jake that he was going to be sit down and talking with Reese Hoffa on a podcast, I would ask what's a podcast, but then I'll say that's amazing. So,
yeah,
you know, thank you so much for taking time out of your day.
Well, thank you for having me, number one. I love podcasts.
You should really do it.
Yeah.
That's when you're looking for something to do. Trust me, it's very time consuming, especially the editing part. I think that's how you fill up that extra time that you're worried about.
Yeah, I've done three. I've recorded Corey and then Ryan Whiting and Kurt Roberts. We did one while I was in Kansas last year, and I haven't edited it down yet. I did it, and I wasn't quite happy with the quality. Like I needed to be more professional like you, but I think in the future, you know, maybe I'll do it anyway and send it off to somebody that can edit it and make it a little clearer. Cause you kind of get the sound isn't all the way there. They can amplify your voice and all that kind of stuff.
I can put you in touch with some wonderful people. Don does a fantastic job.
Okay. So you know, I might do that this year. I think it'll be something fun and give me some memories while for my last year. I wish I would have had it when I was in Portland this year, but you know, when it comes to throwing, this has been a crazy ride. Telling my parents after 4 years of college or 5 years, 5.5 years of college mm-hmm. almost, saying, hey, I want to become a thrower. And them going, well, you just went to college to be a PE teacher. What are you crazy? And then 20 years later, I am still throwing. I've had a crazy ride. This is the most awesome job any person could ever have. And I really can't wait to, I guess, have a real job because I haven't had a job in 20 years now.
Well, good. Thank you so much, Reese. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a DSCT.TV production.